Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And today we begin our show by talking about a very long-running public radio show aired across the nation. I think I've heard it since its beginning. And it's called Away With Words. And I bet many of you listening in today will have heard it here on WPR stations. I listen, and it's aired 11 a.m. on Sundays, and it's co-hosted by our first guest today, Martha Barnett. Hi, Martha.
Hello. It's great to be here, Larry.
Thanks for joining us, and Grant Barrett. Grant, thank you for joining in.
Hi, Larry.
It's wonderful to have you both here. They'll be in Madison. They're with me by Google Meet at the present, but I can see their smiling faces. They will be with us in Madison Sunday, October 26th, so coming right up for the Wisconsin Book Festival Fall Celebration. I think they're talking at noon at the Madison Public Library. But as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. Martha's got a new book out, and it is really a dandy. I had so much fun. I've got it just late. I read it over the weekend and had so much fun with it. It's titled Friends with Words, Adventures in Language Land. And you are going to learn a lot and have a whole lot of fun if you read her book or when you read your book. You may not have read it yet, but you may have heard Away With Words, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along today. What do you think about Away With Words? Maybe you have a question. I see we already have at least one question coming up in our email. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. You know, just to begin with, there are people listening who have probably not heard the show. Describe Away With Words.
Well, as you said, it's a very long-running public radio show, and it's all about language, about words and how we use them. So that includes all kinds of things like word origins, phrase origins, regional dialects. We love talking about that. Linguistic diversity, grammar, maybe disputes you've had in the office about this or that turn of phrase. And I like to add that weird thing that your grandparent used to say. You know, you don't know if it's their phrase or, you know, if they made it up or if other people say it.
Yeah, my father-in-law said, well, I wonder what the word crupsin means. We're crupsin around. Have you ever heard of that?
Crupsin? Do you know how to spell
crupsin,
it?
Crupsin. K-R-U. I would spell it K-R-U-P-S-I-N. Like we're crupsin around, like maybe fooling around or whatever.
Uh-huh. Well, there are lots of words for that. I've never heard that one, so that makes me really excited. Grant's shaking his head as well, so that thrills us. We'll have to dig deeper on that. Crupsin. I mean, you can kind of guess what it means, right, just from the way that you say it.
Oh, yeah. Crupsin it's around. Fooling around.
Yeah, so, we're crupsing around right now, right?
We're doing a little of that. Grant, what'd you think of Martha's book when you read it? You probably had a hand in a little helping here and there.
No, not at all, actually. I didn't even know that she was going to write so extensively about me. So the best parts of the book are, of course, about me. Just turn to the index, find my name, and all the pages are listed there. No, it's a wonderful book. She's done a great job of capturing what we do on the show and how much delight we get from doing the show. And it's easy to say, oh, he's just saying that. But no, we really enjoy this interplay with all the different ways that people speak, not just in the United States and Canada, but around the world. It's kind of astonishing that this fundamental tool that separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom is something that just gives and gives and gives.
Yeah, we've never run out of things to talk about. I mean, I've been doing this show for 21 years now. And Wisconsin listeners have a lot to do with that. They ask great questions, and we're looking forward to hearing lots more of those when we come to Madison on the 26th.
You know, and Wisconsin Public Radio goes all the way back to the beginning of Away With Words, because ours was the only station or stations carrying Away With Words.
That's true. Yeah, it goes back to our previous co-hosts on the show, Richard Lederer, who's written something like 60 books now about language. He started the show along with Charles Harrington Elster, whose books on pronunciation people might know as well. And they initially did the show, and I think Richard had some kind of connection with Wisconsin. It was based at KPBS here in San Diego, where Grant and I both live. But there was some...
You know what?
What's that?
I looked into it. I looked into it because I was interested in how what the connection was. And then when Jack Mitchell, who was our program director back in the day and a really smart and gifted guy, told me in an email last night one of my co-hosts way back then was Gene Faraca. And Gene Faraca had a wonderful call-in show. And Richard Lederer became one of her regular guests. And so well before the start of Away With Words, Richard was on the show. And you could tell they became great, good friends. And the show was dynamic and lovely, lots of calls and so forth. And so Jack and now myself, and I remember I remembered hearing Richard Lederer on the show. So I'm convinced that Gene Faraca had a lot to do with that, and maybe even something to do with how Away With Words was originally formatted.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And we've always kind of wondered about that, because for a while the show was just on in San Diego and I think Wisconsin, and people thought that that was a kind of a strange combination. But we've since expanded to what, Grant, 44 states, something like that?
Yeah, 300 something signals around the country, and of course by podcast around the world.
I am so pleased to have you as guests, and I want people to know how much you've cared about this show and the effort you put into keeping this show going, as you so well point out in your book, what you had to do to keep Away With Words going, Martha.
Well, yes, Grant and I and our producer, Stephanie Levine, who met her husband there at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. She's a graduate of Madison, as well as her husband and their daughter. Anyway, all of us, the three of us, Grant, Stephanie, and I, made a lot of sacrifices in order to keep the show going, because In 2007, right at the beginning of the recession then, KPBS ran out of funds to produce the show. And so they canceled our show and another show. But the three of us thought, you know, our ratings have never been better. The show means so much to so many people. We've got to find a way to keep going. And so eventually we formed a little nonprofit ourselves and do our own fundraising and distribute the show. And the show has since grown, as we said, but there were a lot of lean years. We held down different jobs in order to keep this going, but we just believed in it so much. And the response that we got from listeners also kept us going. We had volunteers working with us to help raise funds, and we've had so much support over the years that we've been delighted to be able to keep going.
And you, and as you said in the book, you went for 3 years without a salary, with no money.
Yeah, Yeah, kind of drained the savings a little bit and, you know, picked up work where we could. But, you know, when you really believe in something that much, you find ways to make it work.
And, Grant, you came on the show in 2007 and replaced Richard Lederer. And one of the fine quotes I think that Martha included in the book was actually something from the New York Times, which called you at the time, you were among a new wave of young, hip lexicographers, which go ahead. How do you interpret it?
I am neither of those adjectives any longer, neither young nor hip. But yeah, that's how I got hooked up with the show. I was a lexicographer, which is somebody who makes dictionaries for Oxford University Press, working on a big historical slang project. And I filled in for Richard Lederer a couple of times. And then they put the call out for a permanent replacement host, and I applied and made it through the process and joined Martha. And so for years, I recorded from New York. And once we got in the same studio, though, once I ended up in San Diego, and we developed a different rapport. It is better to start recording in the same physical space. You see each other's visual cues. And even, you know, right now on this call, we're all on Google Meet. But it's still not the same to have a camera as it is to be in the same space and hear that little sound that Martha makes before she's going to speak. Or even we would do visual things, like we'd put up our finger, meaning I have something to say. But now I think we understand each other's rhythm enough that we record in separate spaces again. So we're kind of back to how we started.
You know, David Appleton has a question relating to the workings of the show, and I wanted to get into that anyway, but let's go to Dave. Dave, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, you've got an excellent program, so knowledgeable. You seem to have an answer for almost everything, and I'm wondering, is this personal knowledge, or are you sitting in front of a computer pulling things off the internet as you speak?
You know what? But this is a call-in show, and yours is a call-out show in some ways.
It's true. The show presents as live, and we kind of have to do it that way because it is on a bunch of times all over the country during the week. It's not, you know, it's not a live satellite broadcast. And the nice advantage that comes from it not having to be live is that we get to pick our callers from all the different ways we talk to and with listeners. So if you leave a voicemail or send an email or send a WhatsApp message, you're still considered a candidate for the show. And then we'll go through all that incoming stuff. And Martha and I will pick some people. We're like, oh, yeah, this is something we need to talk about. Talk to our producer. She'll arrange it. And then we schedule everything for a recording session as if it's live. And so we have come into the recording studio knowing who we're going to talk to and what we're going to talk about. And some people feel like that's cheating, but I always say that the premise of this show isn't two people on a high wire trying not to fall. The premise of the show is how can we inform a huge community of listeners about language? And so we want to make sure to get our ducks in a row. Dates correct, titles correct, know what we're talking about. Has any new work been done by our linguist colleagues? That's happening all the time. We read the journals, we read the books, we read everything. Listen to other language podcasts, other language radio shows, so that when we come into the studio, we have boned up. This is like an LSAT every week, you know?
Martha, you got something to add there for sure.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say that I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with Car Talk. And our previous producer, the one who preceded Stephanie Levine, actually spent a week with those guys, the Car Talk guys, in Boston to find out how they did their show. And they did their show the same way. It was what is called in the business a call-out show. And so this show is modeled. It's sort of like Car Talk, but for words.
Yeah, I was on a national show for quite a long time, too, called Calling All Pets. And we
set it up. That was a great show. I love that show.
We set it up that way as well, although our producer, I think the range of questions for Calling All Pets was much narrower than it was than it is for you two.
Yeah.
So we would, she would pick, the producer would, out of the couple hundred calls you'd get, she would pick the questions and line them up. And so we wouldn't know what they were, what the questions were going to be, but they were all lined up in a row, and mm-hmm. we would record them all on a Wednesday morning between 8 and whatever, you know, 10.
Yep. Yep.
And Larry, we can do it live. So
yeah.
Martha, yes. Martha's been at this 20 plus years. I've been at it 18 plus years. We both have language careers before this show. And so we know a little bit. And so come see us live, do the Q&A. The Q&A yeah. is always one of the our favorite parts of our live presentations. And you will see us walking along a wire, trying not to fall as we answer your questions.
People on wire.
Oh, boy. Aaron in Madison has something. He's curious about something. So let's hear from Aaron.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. First off, love the show. I listen every Saturday. Love it a lot. Yeah. Enjoy it. I have a question that's been... that I've always wanted to ask you guys, and it's about the word ask, where in corporate America, oftentimes instead of saying we have a request, we say that we have an ask. And this started about, 15 years ago is when I first started hearing it. And I'm just wondering, why did that ever become a thing? And by the way, I still find it very annoying whenever my boss says, I have an ask.
So what's the ask? Is the sort of as what Aaron's talking about.
Yeah, well, those kinds of things become jarring or are jarring when you first hear them. But, I mean, have you ever gone to a meet and greet, for example? I mean, a lot of these verbs end up becoming nouns. I'm trying to think of other examples of that, Grant.
Well, my favorite one is if you have an ask, do you have a tell? A tell is a thing that gives you away, you know,
there
like
you
if you're playing poker and trying to bluff. So it's really common for words to be borrowed as another part of speech that's related to the earlier part of speech. And this particular noun form of ask, meaning a question or a request, you know, is hundreds of years old. So.
Yeah, I was going to say that you know, I think something like 20% of English nouns started out as verbs and went through a process of what they call denominalization. It works the other way as well. I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, the word email, for example, that started out as a noun, but we email each other all the time. It became a verb.
Yeah,
I will say that the modern ask, particularly if you're asking for a donation or you're asking for a price, probably had a resurgence in the 80s because of Wall Street and stock trading. So there's an ask price, and that is shortened in the jargon of Wall Street and the stock market to an ask.
And there you go. The two of you just start talking, and one feeds off the other, and back and forth a bit. You described in your book yourself, Martha, as a high considerateness speaker, and Grant as a high involvement speaker.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the nice ways to put it. Yeah, I mean, I'm from the South. I grew up in Kentucky, and so I have an entirely different way of speaking from Grant's, and both of them are perfectly legitimate. I mean, people in New York, for example, will tend to be, they're high involvement speakers, which means they're listening to you. And one of the ways that they indicate that they're listening to you may be to interrupt or jump in. And, you know, if you're from the South, if you're a recovering Southern belle, like I am, you know, you tend to kind of hang back and listen. And Grant, you probably have things to say about that. So I'll hand the mic to you.
Well, no, I think you're right. So Martha is, as her kind of speaker, more of a turn taker. She sees it more as A, then B, and then A, and then B. And what I see it as collaboration, where two people can, or more can talk at once. And the conversation is a flow, like a river, with lots of streams coming together. And so these are both absolutely ordinary ways of speaking across the human world. But if you are more of one than another, you might see the other person either as slow, if they're a turn taker like Martha, or rude, if they're a collaborative speaker like me.
Yeah, and that's a good thing to be aware of when you're talking with other people, because as I said, both of those ways of speaking are legitimate. And if you recognize that, then it, you know, you can each make adjustments, which Grant and I have learned to do over the years.
Yeah, we've structured the show a little bit to give Martha the space so I'm not automatically treading on her toes.
Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett, our guests today. They are co-hosts, co-producers of Away with Words. Martha has a new wonderful book out called Friends with Words, Adventures in Language Land. Great to have them with us. And you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett, the co-hosts of Away with Words, a radio show. You hear it on Sunday mornings at 11 on our NPR news stations. Martha's also an author, and her newest book is Friends with Words, Adventures in Language Land. Lots of people online to visit and on the phone. Our phones are all full, as I expected they would be. But Mary in Middleton, let's go to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hello, Larry. I first want to thank you all for all the wonderful years of entertainment and education that I've gotten listening to your shows. And Martha, I'd like to tell you about my mother, who was educated as an English teacher in the early 1940s. And later had nine children that were brought up with very correct English. And when I first told her about Away with Words, Richard Lederer was on, and I would call her. She lived in La Crosse. I was in Middleton to let her know about Away with Words. And after the show was over, I would call her back, and we would always have this wonderful discussion about what we had learned and the entertainment that you had given us. And that continued to be, as she got dementia, one of her favorite times and memories.
Oh, Mary, that's a lovely, lovely memory. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. That really is true about the show, that that we hear from people who say, you know, I heard this word on your show, and I know my dad used to say it, and I called him up, and we had a long conversation about it. And I love it when people compile family lexicons. You know, they put together a list of all these words that that the family used and they remember. And so that's a really precious memory that you had. And that's the kind of thing that keeps Grant and me going with the show. So thank you for sharing that.
You hear me. I'm sure you get a lot of wonderful feedback.
Oh, we do indeed. Yes.
Catherine in Ironwood, Michigan. Your turn. Hi, Catherine.
Hi there. I love both of your shows, everybody's shows. My question is about a single word. I'm 74 years old. I got my first dog when I was 4 years old, and my mother said, if you want them to go out and do their business, you say, "Up's the poozer." And I've said that for 70 years.
Up's the poozer.
Last year, when I realized how old I am, I thought, you know, come on, is this a real word? I don't know. But and every dog responded to it without problem. Every dog.
And we would spell that UPSAPOOZER. Up's a poozer.
That's a new one on me. I haven't heard that one. But, you know, that would be a great call to talk about what you tell your dog. I used to tell my dog, hurry up, because I read some book by a bunch of monks who raise dogs in upstate New York, and that's the term they use. Hurry up, hurry up. But upsapoozer is... That'll get you going, right?
Yeah, kind of sounds like ups a daisy.
Yeah, but poozer.
But poozer, and poozer kind of like poocher.
Yeah.
Pooch.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're, you know, I'm just, having read your book,
yes.
Now, at least I think more. I look at words different. I've been looking at words a little more differently since just reading the book. It's a book that I will hang on to, I think, forever, because there's so many interesting usages. There are phrases in there that in your book that I am sure to want to use. And when I see somebody kind of mad, I'm going to say, well, who licked the red off your candy?
yeah, who licked the red off your candy? And that's an expression that I learned from one of our listeners. And that's another one of the joys of the show, is that Grant and I both learn so much from, I mean, people are basically crowdsourcing language here and information about language. And we really appreciate everybody who does that. But yeah, a listener called us to say that, I think it was her mother used to always say, well, who licked the red off your candy? Which I think is such an evocative phrase for, you know, what are you so angry about? But it comes from a song that was kind of this joke song by a guy named Little Jimmy Dickens. And it's a real toe tapper. You can find recordings of him singing Who Licked the Red Off Your Candy on YouTube. But, you know, the idea is that a little girl had a lollipop and a dog licked the red off.
Well, there's another story. You're going to laugh a lot. After you read this book, you're going to laugh a lot. And it's based on so many things, not only your own life, which was really fascinating in and of itself, Martha, but it based on the thousands of calls, millions of calls probably that you've had and the enlightenment that one gets from this sort of engagement. One story, I definitely want to have you tell this story about how different words mean different things to people. And you tell a story in the book, which came from the show itself, and it had to do with a caller coming in. She was in Canada, wanted to get a knit cap.
Mm-hmm.
She was from North Carolina or someplace.
Yeah, she was from North Carolina, and she went into a coffee shop in Canada because it was particularly cold. And she asked this coffee shop happened to sell merchandise, and the merchandise included these warm woolen caps. And so she said, yeah, I'd like a cup of coffee and a toboggan. And the person looked at her like, what? Because toboggan can mean a couple of different things, depending on where you're from. It can mean either a warm woolen cap or a sled. And the term goes back to the Algonquian family of languages, where that were a similar sounding word meant a kind of wooden sled. And over time, it also came to mean the kind of hat that you might wear on that kind of sled that had the same curve to it.
I'm thinking back to your conversation. You worked for 12 years with a professor, off and on, Leonard Lutkowski, about languages. And I think he said languages aren't arbitrary. There are faintly visible footprints if you know how to look for them or where to look for them.
Yeah, and that's one of the joys of etymology, that there are hidden connections between and among words that are hiding right there in plain sight if only you know how to look for them, in part because so many languages arose from Proto-Indo-European, this prehistoric language that like a tree, sent out roots and branches all over the world, or all over much of the world, so that that we have cognate terms in different languages as different as Irish and Russian and Greek and Italian and English. And if you know about those roots, then you can start making connections between and among those words and see the roots, these linguistic fossils that are right there inside a single word. Every word has a story to tell. And so yes, as my tutor said, Professor Litkovsky said, language is not arbitrary at all.
Sharon and DePere, what's on your mind?
Hi, love your show. I'm an English major and a librarian, so words Whoa. Are my thing.
Nice.
I get concerned about the new generation with texting and social media and clipping words and clipping phrases. Is good language going to go away with all of this kind of change in our language?
Grant, what do you think?
Well, I would say that this question has been around as long as language has been around. I think Plato argued about it. And also, as long as texting has been around, which we're talking about more than 30 years now, people have been talking about what texting is doing to the language. And so far, it has contributed maybe a handful of lexical items to English, but otherwise it's had no impact, outside the technological terms. But the larger interesting thing when you talk about clipping words, I love the P.G. Woodhouse books, the Bertie Wooster and Jeeves stories. And these books, I think written from the 30s through the 60s, have Bertie Wooster, who's this kind of flighty, wealthy, I don't know what you would say, upper class person who's always getting into scrapes and trying to help out his friends and things go wrong. But he clips books. He clips words throughout the books, throughout the stories, obviously abbreviated as obs, for example. And so this kind of clipping in slangy everyday language is nothing new as well. And as a matter of fact, abbreviations as a matter of writing go back to the oldest written documents that we can find, where in order to conserve space, the scribe, whatever their medium, whether it be parchment or clay, would just put the few key consonants of the word or the name. And just so you got the point, but you didn't need it spelled out, didn't need it elaborated. So it is very ordinary to shorten words in all languages of the world.
Very good. As you were talking, I was thinking about what I would tell my broadcast students in classes. I would say if you write it in active voice, it's going to be about 20%. You'll use 20% fewer words than if you write it in passive voice. That's a different way to kind of a little different take on what you were talking about. But active voice is more efficient and also more conversational.
Yeah, I think it can be very, very effective. I would just add, in terms of that last call, that librarians are heroes to Grant and me. So
yes, absolutely.
So, yeah,
on our short list, there's room in the boat for you. So,
Rusty and Portage, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi! I'm a big fan of the show. I was also a fan of the show Says You. I enjoy programs about words. And they used to have a segment that they said, well, what's the difference? For instance, what's the difference between a graveyard and a cemetery? Well, a cemetery is non sequitur and a graveyard is attached to a church. I didn't know that until I heard it. But I'd like to know what's the difference between flotsam and jetsam?
Are you from a sailing or naval background?
No, but I've read a lot, and I've seen the term used several times.
In a lot of different ways.
Yeah, so we use these to mean odds and ends, but they come from Latin originally. There's a word, the flotsam comes from a word meaning to float, and jetsam comes from a word meaning to throw. And so flotsam is stuff that isn't meant to be in the sea, like maybe it is from a shipwreck or something that washed out into the sea. And jetsam is stuff that you have deliberately thrown into the sea.
There you go, Rusty. Thank you very much for calling. Kimberly wondered if there's your thoughts on the overuse of some phrases, like there's a lot to unpack.
Yeah. So one of the things that we do as radio hosts is try not to fall back on our own crutches, our own things, the phrases that are where you go when you're still organizing your thoughts. And one of the things we also try to teach our listeners is that when you find yourself confronted with a linguistic prejudice in your own mind or something irritates you, ask yourself why it is. And often it's because we don't understand what's happening. And in this case, if you allow the other person a break and say, oh, they're just organizing their thoughts, they want to be clear, they want to connect with me, then you're going to find yourself much more relieved. You're going to find yourself quite relieved. They're like, oh, okay, yeah, that's why they're leaning on these phrases so heavily. That's why they're taking this extra time or this extra space to get it right.
I remember just from a couple of weeks ago, someone called with a phrase or a word, and I can't remember it now, but in trying to answer it, You use the word as a way, you know, as part of, as you were talking about, Grant.
Yeah.
Moving yourself from one to the other, and you had an awful time getting out of that.
Yeah.
It's an I can't remember, but
it might have been yeah, we those, but sometimes we do it just to tease each other and goad each other. Me and Martha like to do that across the mic, or just to let the listener know that we're treating this with a great deal of humor, and we don't consider any real language problems to be, you know, unless it's something congenital or it has to do with something unfortunate happening with somebody's body or brain. We mostly don't consider these to be life-threatening. You know, we don't consider these to be signs of the apocalypse.
Well, I appreciate how, and we try to do this on this show too, is to honor our callers and honor our people and treat everyone with respect, which I think is even in your stated goal for the for the show. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you so much for being with us. Boy, you know, we could have spent a lot more time here talking about this, but we, radio, we're going to talk about cranberries next, but, and it's going to be an interesting conversation. And,
absolutely.
And it's been a fun one with you two, and Martha and Grant, thank you so much for what you do and for the wonderful show you produce. I love it. And the book.
Thank you, Larry.
The book is great.
Well, thank you. We are really looking forward to coming to the book festival. We just did a book festival here in California. I just got back from one in Tennessee. And book festivals are just the best. You know, just all these kindred spirits there. And people are so lovely. And we just can't wait to get to Madison.
And thanks to everyone. Sorry. Collaborating there.
And one of my best pals.
Thanks to everyone who called it. Sorry.
One of my best pals heads up the book festival. And you're going to enjoy her. And you're really going to like the main library. It's going to be
fantastic.
A sight to behold. Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett. So much fun talking with them. Their show is titled Away with Words. You can hear them Sunday mornings. Listen in with me at 11 o'clock as I listen to it on Sunday mornings. And Martha's book, Friends with Words, Adventures in Language Land, which you're going to enjoy a lot. You're going to laugh. You're going to find out a lot more about this show and about Martha. And you're going to appreciate all of the words and phrases you're going to learn about. Lots there. And as I said, coming up, we are going to turn our attention to cranberries. We are a big producer of cranberries here in Wisconsin. We're the leaders, and we're going to talk with one of the leaders of the cranberry industry. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Turning our attention to cranberries here on the program now. You know, for I think it's more than three decades, Wisconsin has led the nation in cranberry production. We're also the single largest source of cranberries in the world. And we're going to talk about cranberries. We're right in the harvest season for it. And Grant Holly is our guest. Grant is executive director of the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers Association. So, do you like the tangy taste of cranberry juice or maybe dried cranberries known as craisins? Do you know most of the world's cranberries are grown right here in our state? Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Grant Holly, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much. We are thrilled to be here. It's the right time of year for us.
Oh, it really is. The season, harvest season right on. How's the crop looking?
It looks like we're going to be down this year. We had such a huge year last year. We were probably two or three cranberries shy of the entire record last year. Cranberries are perennial plants, which means they come back year after year. But just like us, once you have had two or three banner years in a row, you kind of want to take a weekend to sit on the couch. It's kind of where our cranberries went this year. They started to take this year off. We had some crazy weather here in Wisconsin right up until harvest, and I think that pushed some of our cranberries into they go dormant a little bit earlier. So we are down for the year, but we're not too far off the average.
And so what's the average? How much do we produce every year?
That's a good question. We produce about 5 million cranberries a year, 5 million barrels. I apologize. 5 million barrels. A barrel is 100 pounds of cranberries. So just take that 5 million and multiply by 100, and that gives you how many pounds we actually produce. Last year, as an example, we were over 6 million pounds of cranberries. And this year, it looks like we're going to be close to around 4.7 would be my best guess right now.
And I'm wondering about the jobs. I mean, there must be a lot of people tied in with this.
We do. We have over 4,000 jobs in the state are directly tied to cranberries. And then you have the external folks as well. So whether it's going to be farm machinery, whether it's going to be the truckers, whether it's going to be none of the other jobs, that's just going to add to it as well. Their entire communities. You look at the Warrens community, you look at the Cranmore community, those entire communities are somehow, some way tied to cranberries. And there are a number of those across the state. It's these guys have been on their marshes for 100, 150 years. So they're pretty much considered family at this point in time for their communities.
You know, I think it'd be fun to talk about the process with cranberries. I mean, I've got lots more to talk about, but I think can you talk about, you know, from the start of the year, it's a perennial crop.
Yeah.
But talk about how it's set up and throughout the year, what happens through to harvest.
Well, these guys are busy all year long. And sometimes we use harvest as we call it the end of our year, which really the next year starts the very next day. So if we start in the wintertime, would be the best time to be able to call it. So we'll go from winter to fall. So in the wintertime, the vines are still in the ground. They're still kind of incubating there. The berries for the upcoming year are actually already on the vines. So the berries take longer than a year to be able to develop. The berries that we just harvested were actually fertilized a year and a half ago. So the berries for this upcoming year are already on the vine, which means we got to be able to protect them. If you look, they just look like little nuggets, like itty bitty teeny tiny things on the vine. They haven't really turned into a berry yet. So in the beginning part of the winter, when the temperatures are just like Wisconsin, we know it, that it's like we wear our bathing suit in the day in the noon and we're in a winter coat by 8 o'clock at night. We will typically do things called frost watch. So we will use our sprinklers and our irrigation to put water on top of the berries. So as we get to frost, if heat needs to come from somewhere, it'll come from the water rather than the berry, and it just protects them in those big temperature gradients. Once Wisconsin decides that it's time for us all to put the big coat on for the year, then what we like to do is we will flood the marshes and we wait for about 6 to 10 inches of ice to form on top. And then we drain the bottom. So we basically created an ice cave for the berries. The berries were found here. Cranberries are native. It's one of the most important things about them. Before there were people, there were cranberries. And when people got here, they tried to grow other things and the land was too stubborn. And they decided to just grow what they found, which was cranberries. So they can handle those ice caves just fine. When it gets to negative 40, they don't handle that real well. So we like to put them protected under the ice. We will then take sand and we'll drive big trucks on top of the ice. It's nice and thick. And we put sand on top of the ice. So as it melts in the spring, we get a re-sanding. So we actually add new sand on top of our soil. It really helps with weeds, helps with pests. That takes us directly into the spring. And in the springtime, we're all about the flowers. We got flowers, we got blooms, we got bees. It is a pretty, pretty, pretty time of year. But at this point, what we're really trying to do is just make sure nothing hurts the berries. Nothing hurts the plants. Nothing hurts the vines. We watch for smoke. Bees and smoke don't get along. Bees see the smoke, they go home. That's how you control bees. So that can affect pollination. From there, all we're doing is just feeding them when we need to feed them. We're keeping them happy. In the north, we always watch for frost, even in the heat of the summer. And they start to plump up and we hit harvest. And that takes us right back into the wintertime. But there's a job for every season.
Yeah, there sure is. And then the water, the flooding happens, does it not again?
That's we flood there for harvest. The nice thing about cranberries is that they float. Cranberries way back in the day, back in the 1800s, before they started using water for the harvest, they used rakes, and it worked when you only had a few hundred berries. Now that we're measuring things in millions of pounds, hundreds of millions of pounds, what makes that possible is that they float. So we will flood the marshes with about 10 inches of water. We take a little specialized tractor that goes in and just gently knocks the berries off. They float to the top. We add in a little bit more water, and we take a glorified wet dry vac, and we basically just suck them up, and you've done a harvest, and it kind of works things out real well.
Oh, my gosh. What a great description. You did a fine job there, Grant, of describing that.
I had a little bit of practice this year. It's all good.
Grant Holley is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Cranberry Growers Association, and we'll be talking to him for another half hour about cranberries, and we certainly want to hear from you. Maybe you're a cranberry farmer yourself. I'd love to hear you call in with a comment, or maybe you just have questions about cranberries themselves or the products that come from them. You can give a call, and we'll talk about that. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News. Then we'll be back with Grant Holley. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News, where we've turned our attention to cranberries, that tart, dark red fruit grown in marshes and harvested every October. And they are pretty much known the world over. Larry Mueller here, having some fun talking with Grant Holley, executive director of the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers Association, talking about the history of growing cranberries in our state, how Wisconsin growers are meeting the global demand. Somebody typed in, Grant, that you should star in a Hallmark Christmas movie set on a cranberry farm.
Well, as a single person, I got to tell them that I tried that at a Christmas farm, and I was even wearing flannel last year. And I got to wonder if those Hallmark movies are lying to us, to be real honest. And we do need one. If it was centered around cranberries, we'd love to have it. But I think they're absolutely right. It could actually be a nice setting. It'd be awesome.
It would be in a very colorful setting as well. Logan in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Logan.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
So I was curious about the relationship between wolf spiders, and in the bog when they flood. You know, I've always wondered, like, what drew them to that sort of environment, and, you know, when they flood it, you know, they kind of are all over the surface of the water. So just, you know, curious about that relationship.
Wolf spiders.
See, okay, I had a betting pool started, but a legal one, and it was, when was the first spider question going to hit, and I had number one, and you just won me $5, so that is beautiful. It's one of our most popular questions, to be real honest, and I love it because it helps to tell the cranberry story. Do we have spiders in the marshes? You bet we do. We love our spiders because they're a natural predator. They're going to take out the bugs that we don't like. The more spiders we have, the less of anything else that we have to worry about. Our number one pesticide is ice. So in that nice cold Wisconsin winters, we love it. And when we get down to about negative 20, because I can hear the blunt-nosed leafhopper freeze to death and screaming out there in the cold, and I just cackle. So we're happy about that. The spiders are a close second. And they are there. We want to see them there. Cranberries, and because, again, they're perennial, and they are naturally here. They're local. This is where they are indigenous. They are not an introduced species. The entire ecosystem grew up with them. So those spiders grew up with the cranberries. You want to see them. So I grew up in the hills of Appalachia. My grandmother, who's one of the smartest people on earth, always said that if she goes to a farm and she doesn't see bugs, she leaves because something's wrong. So the fact that you see our spiders there, the fact that you see a full ecosystem there, really indicates some of the health of what we do. That being said, there are some, I know this is going to come as a shocker. Don't believe everything you see on the internet. Keep it to yourselves. Don't let anybody else know, but don't do that. The internet does have some stories that we raise them. We corral them. Cranberry cowboys, it just makes for a great picture. There's a t-shirt there somewhere, but we don't do that. There's enough natural. When we flood our marshes, one thing about spiders and our friends is they're not dumb. the big ones, they just walk away and they wait. They've seen it before. Just like a normal wetland when it floods, spiders don't wait around to drown. They walk away. So the big ones will go up into the woods and you can watch them go, and it's kind of fun. The smaller ones, that they float. So you will see some on the water. You'll see some that are around, but they're perfectly natural. The smaller ones, they'll float for a little while, but they also do this really cool thing of sending a web out, and they kind of turn themselves into kites. So that's kind of interesting as well. But it's a nice piece of the natural environment. So do we have them? We absolutely have them. If you go out to see a marsh, are you going to be tackled by hordes of spiders? You're not. Are they kind of our friends? They are. Do we ever get bit? In the 2 years now that I've been out to a couple of harvests and I've had waders on and been out in the water, I might have had one bite, but it suspiciously looked an awful lot like a mosquito bite at the same time. So these guys, they're not too bad. They're part of our ecosystem. We love them. They help us out, and hopefully we help them out too.
Yeah. Logan, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Heidi in Friendship, Wisconsin. Hi, Heidi.
Thank you so much for having me on. I had to call because I was very impressed with how Grant explained the whole process of cranberries. I was a teacher for 24 years in Juneau County in the Nisita School District, and every year we would go out to the Cutler Cranberry Marsh, where Lisa Potter would tell the students, you know, all about cranberries, and we just enjoyed it so much. Usually, you know, it was always a miserably rainy day. Yeah. And, you know, I think out of 24 years, I maybe got two that were sunny, but, you know, the chaperones would hang in there and we'd be freezing to death and learning about cranberries. So I learned about the ice caves from you, though. I had never heard that. Lisa maybe left that out, or maybe I was chasing kids at the time to make them pay attention. But now the spiders, that was new to me. I didn't know about that. But I also wanted to mention the Cranberry Discovery Center in Warrens. That was also a really neat place to take kids. And I just, you know, I've been retired now for 3 years, and I miss it. I miss going to that cranberry marsh in the fall and just experiencing the whole Wisconsin cranberry story.
Yeah. Well, Heidi, you could still go. You know, there are some cranberry festivals, are there not, Grant?
We got cranberry festivals. We got folks that will do tours. I know Lisa. If you sit back and you tell Lisa, I used to come out with my classes. Lisa's going to take you out if she's not up to her elbows in cranberries itself. That's a huge shout out to them. Some of the finest people you're ever going to meet. Come on back out. That Discovery Center is fabulous as well. That entire area, you'd be hard pressed to not find good information. You come out in the fall when the leaves are pretty, the berries are pretty. You are seeing Wisconsin at its finest, and I would recommend everybody to do it. The only PSA that I would throw out is, and it really hits people from Illinois more than Wisconsin. Wisconsin, our common sense, we know our farmers, but please just don't pull off the road and go walking into a marsh. They are set into the ground. There are ditches here and there, and they can be dangerous. Call ahead. Find a farmer. You can go to our website. We have a list of folks, and they are proud. If you think that I talk a lot about cranberries, just hold your horses. They are so proud of what they do. They are more than happy to show folks around. Just let them know you're coming.
Heidi, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. This is a great little story you told there, Heidi, and a great comment from back from Grant. Jill in Rice Lake, let's go to you next. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. I would say 30 years ago, I went to the Warren Cranberry Fest, and there I bought a watercolor of the cranberry, of the berries, but also the blossom. And I was told by the artist that it was called the cranberry because the blossom looks like a crane head. Is this accurate? And, you know, I kind of doubt it because I'm thinking the natives named them something. But
yeah, a little of the history on that, Grant.
You actually are 100% correct. So if you go out and take a look at the flowers look a lot like sandhill cranes, from the coloring to the shape, and they were originally called crane berries. But of course, just like good Americans, we shorten words all the time. I mean, let's face it, it's the newer generation. They're down to LOLs and W and all those kind of fun things. So they're just down to letters. We just cut cranberries down, or craneberries down to cranberries. But that is 100% accurate. And if you're ever looking for a partner to those paintings, that Warren's Cranfest has only gotten bigger, and the artists are still out there. I remember seeing a few watercolors this past year.
Joe, thank you so much for calling. Rita and Babcock in the Babcock area emailed to say that they grow cranberries, and Rita wants to know if you think that the Canadian fires smoke affected the bees and thus pollinating this growing season.
So the flowers that were just out, so the ones that were there in June, those are going to make the berries for next year. The berries from this year came from the June previously, but we had smoke then as well. Everybody that I talk to, whether they are a cranberry farmer or even a beekeeper, and they're saying that the behaviors are absolutely being affected. So that is bound to affect our volume, if you will. So cranberries are not self-pollinating like other plants. We have to have those pollinators. We have to have native pollinators. And yeah, the smoke on those heavy smoke days, bees naturally, they just go back home is what they do. And they don't come out as much as they used to. And those flowers have a shelf life for how long that they're viable. So is it affecting us? It is. Is there anything that we can do about it? Not a whole lot. Welcome to agriculture. We're always facing a challenge. But yeah, any of we throw out those prayers of no hail during the flowering time, but we're also starting to throw out the prayers of no smoke during our flowering time either.
And, you know, relating to the bees, do the growers bring in bees? My future son-in-law's they have a bee farm and honey farm, and they ship, for example, they'll ship bees to California in the wintertime to do the work there. Is that what the cranberry growers do?
The only thing harder working than a cranberry grower are those bees, because even when we get a little bit of a nap in the winter, those bees go to Texas. So, yes, they are native. So we do use local groups, Wisconsin-based beekeepers, but the Wisconsin beekeepers will rotate their bees as well. But yeah, we bring in bees, especially for the larger marshes. Some of our smaller marshes can handle with the native pollinators that they already have in place. But some of our marshes are so large that we rent them. And we rent them through some Wisconsin beekeepers. Keep them here and tell them to contact cranberry folks, because we're always looking for bees, to be real honest. If we have, we literally have billions and billions of cranberries. It's had a few school groups run the math, and we have somewhere around 146 billion cranberries a year. So that means that we have 146 billion flowers at the minimum that need to be pollinated. That's a lot.
Boy, yeah, that is. Do any of the cranberry folks have their own bees, raise their own bees?
Several do. It's a lot of folks, especially as our marshes. So most of our marshes started with one family. Those families have kids, and then those kids have kids. So you typically have marshes these days with multiple families living on them. Well, there are more than just cranberry jobs that are out there, and some of the families are going over to beekeeping. And a number of people are putting bees on their own property. It does help with the pollination during the year, but then it also creates another incredibly natural and healthy product. And you're going to see a lot of farmers markets. People are having cranberry honey. And it's good stuff. I mean, graft goals, to be honest.
It is indeed. Tree and Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Tree.
Hi. I just want to say that the explanation of how you grow the cranberries was extraordinary. I saw the whole picture of everything happening there. My question is, I'd like to know if you use pesticides to harvest your cranberries.
Okay.
Not all the time. As I mentioned before, one of our best pesticides, and actually the number one that we use, is ice. Because cranberries were grown here and they were found here, most of their natural predators, so most of their natural bugs that will get on them, there are natural ways to be able to combat them. It's not like bringing in a crop from another area to here, and they don't have any defenses against native bugs. Cranberries, native cranberries and native bugs grew up together. So it's sort of like this ecological ecosystem, tit for tat, finding ways to be able to combat. But one of the things that's nice is the ice. Again, I'm not kidding. When I actually see negative 20 outside, I picture those bugs going back to whatever hell bred them, and I'm good with that. And it's one of the most wonderful things. So on a really cold winter, we have usually literally almost no problems when it comes to bugs. Sand is another way. If they did get in there and it was a little bit warmer of a winter and there are eggs in the ground, because we sand during the wintertime, that sand covers the eggs and the eggs don't come into being adults. Now, if we get a very warm winter, which Wisconsin's starting to see, and we're paying very, very, very close attention to, would we have to use a pesticide if ice and sand didn't do the job? Yeah, you're seeing folks starting to use pesticides here and there, not in the amounts that one would think. One piece to remember, again, we're not self-pollinating, so we have to rely on those bees. We can't put a pesticide on that could ever harm bees. Not only does it make the feds nice and angry, but it also goes against our bottom line. We would actually be shorting ourselves money, whereas you might kill a bad bug, you're still killing a good bug. And that's money on the vine for us as well. So we're very careful with those pieces. We also partner very closely with UW, and I want to give a huge shout out to the UW people, because one of the reasons cranberries are so successful here in Wisconsin is because of that partnership with our researchers. And they're helping us get completely away from pesticides as well. Because again, cranberries are grown here. They were found here, and the bugs were as well. There are little itty bitty, and hear me out before you go, ooh. There are little itty bitty worms in all soil that's out there. They're called nematodes. Those nematodes will actually eat the bad bugs. They eat the eggs of the bad bugs. So if we increase those populations in cranberry marshes, we have found a natural way to be able to combat the pests, in which case we don't have to use any chemicals. Those nematodes are natural in the soil to begin with, and they just get a little bit more of bonanza when you're looking at a cranberry marsh, making it healthy for everybody. If you ever take a look, go look. It's out there. They call it the Sinful Seven crops that are out there. Cranberries have never been on that list. We don't plan to be on that list. When they're grown here in Wisconsin, there's so many things going for us that really a natural approach is the best approach that we can go with.
Mark in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my question. I just was wondering, I noticed that maybe a dozen years ago or more, you never saw unsweetened dried cranberries, craisins. And now you are seeing some on the market, but they're quite expensive, maybe double or triple the price of sweetened craisins. And given that you can buy raisins for very cheap, you know, and they're not sweetened at all. I'm just wondering why craisins are, is there some process issue that makes unsweetened craisins much more difficult to produce than sweetened?
Okay.
That's actually, that is a wonderful question. I don't think I've ever gotten that before. But there's some good answers here. You might not like all the answers, but they're good answers here. Accurate answers. How's that? So one of the pieces with your unsweetened dried cranberries, this isn't a grower piece. It's a handler piece. So it's like the industry that takes our berries and then sends them out into the world. They go with market. So they take most of our cranberries and they will add sugar to them in a lot of products because that's what the American people kind of like. We like our sugar. That is starting to have a downturn, which we are thrilled about. I'm like you. I prefer the unsweetened. That's my taste better to me, and that's what I go with. But because of that, the unsweetened are more scarce, which means that the prices are higher. We politic to our handlers all the time to maybe put more unsweetened out there. We do know that some of our handlers, even with some of the sugary juices, there are now sugar-free options. They're also doing cranberry concentrate, which is incredibly healthy. But the piece here, and I'm glad you mentioned raisins themselves. So when cranberries are sweetened, they're actually sweetened to the same level as a raisin. So they actually have the same amount of sugar. But if you look at the nutritional aspects, the cranberries are much more nutritious and they're better for the human body than raisins. So it does always go with personal taste, if you will. But if you're in just looking at sugar levels and you're going to have that much sugar anyway, it's better for your body to basically pound a raisin or pound a cranberry than it is to pound a raisin. We got polyphenol A. We always seen how it actually is affecting the bacteria for UTIs. This past year, we found out that it's also affecting the bacteria that affects ulcers, H. pylori. And if you have a science background, you start to figure out, well, if it's affecting just this bacteria, that's fine. But if it's affecting this bacteria and this bacteria, now you start to question, well, what other bacteria are we actually getting into? And now, even besides a cranberry taking the place of a raisin, it's and I apologize for the kombucha people that are out there, but it's kombucha that tastes good. It's going to affect all the gut bacteria in some very good ways. There's anecdotal evidence for IBS. There's anecdotal evidence for autoimmune. We are actually helping to fund these health research projects to be able to see just how healthy cranberries are. But all of the initial data is looking really good. It's going to take time, as all health research does. But I sincerely hope I'm still in a job in 10 years from now. And I'm back on Larry's program and saying that the FDA has cleared cranberries for X, Y, and Z. Hopefully.
You know what I do this time of the year? I go to the grocery store and I find some fresh cranberries in bags, you know, the size of those bags. And I grab a couple of those that are designated for the freezer. And then I take a handful out when I'm making pancakes and I smash them up and I throw them in the pancake batter. And they are really good that way when you put some maple syrup on them.
I have 12 bags in the freezer right now because just like the caller and just like you, I like those fresh berries.
Yeah.
And I've thrown them in pancakes once before. I got to tell you, I'm a carnivore and I love to take cranberries because they're not a bully. They actually go with so many recipes without robbing flavor. So especially this time of year, take your turkey. And stuffing, you always get all the, did it get hot enough? Other people are using different stuffings. I will take it and I will fill a turkey with cranberries, even the sweet and dried, if you will, or the unsweetened dried. And I put cranberries in that cavity. And when you roast that sucker, it makes an incredible flavor. One of our handlers gave me some jalapeno flavored cranberries, and I put that in a duck. That was a religious experience. It was amazing.
Grant, we are out of time, but I tell you, it has been a real pleasure talking with you. You'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
Oh, you kidding? The love that we just got from the public for cranberries? But my ego will bring me back here day after day, anytime you want.
Grant Holly, Executive Director of the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers Association. It's great to have him with us today. We're going to talk about pizza coming up, and I'm going to ask Dana Spandad if she ever made cranberry pizza. Put some turkey on it. There you go. Next, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. October is National Pizza Month, but who doesn't love pizza any time of the year? Larry Mueller here. Our guest for the rest of the show, Dana Spandad, is chef and owner of Flower Girl and Flame, a pizza restaurant and a mobile food truck based in West Allis. And we'll talk with Dana about her career in food service, her hybrid business that includes a mobile truck and a brick-and-mortar restaurant. And I hope you'll join the conversation. Have you had her pizza? What do you prefer about pizza? The crust, deep, thin crust, deep dish, meat or vegetarian? What's your favorite? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dana, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me, and happy Pizza Month.
Happy Pizza Month to you. I was just talking with about cranberries in Wisconsin. We lead the nation in cranberry production. Did you ever put cranberries on a pizza?
Well, I was listening to the last part of your segment and thinking about all of the pizza that we would put cranberries on. We have done cranberries on pizza. And actually, I just got back from a trip to Door County. And, so we were just surrounded by cherries, cranberries, all of that stuff. We've done a cranberry pizza. We added a little miso. We added some hot chili pepper in there, and it made for a lovely base. We had some bacon, some Wisconsin cheese, and a little bit of crispy sage over the top.
Oh, does that sound good? I was thinking for the meat, you could even use turkey.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've definitely done some post-Thanksgiving, you got to give the people what they want with the leftovers. So, yeah.
Oh, when did you decide to get in the food industry?
I've been in food my whole life. I went to culinary school, did all that. Everyone said, oh, do you want to own your own restaurant? And I said, absolutely not. No, thank you. No. 2020 pushed me into the pizza world in a very big way.
COVID?
Yeah, I was the executive chef at a catering restaurant in 2020, and we were in Las Vegas at a catering conference when they started to shut the buffets down in Vegas. And we came back, and we had, $3.5 million of weddings on the books that just evaporated. And so it was kind of, all right, how do we keep going? So I bought a big wood-fired pizza trailer, and we started scooping up those tiny backyard COVID weddings and, weddings that were supposed to be 250 people that went down to 30 or 40. And we made a scene in Milwaukee.
You know what? That's a great story. I love that.
Yeah.
So you were providing... You figured out a way to provide a valuable service during a really tough time for people and give them something that they could have fun with and celebrate, like a wedding.
Yeah, we're able to do it outdoors, backyards, farms, wineries. We specialize in urban, rustic, chic, sustainably inclusive weddings and events.
I love it. Well, so you opened the business in August of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And you call it Flower Girl and Flame. So you use a and it's a wood-fired pizza oven, right?
Yep. Yeah, all wood-fired. We're using a Wisconsin cherry wood.
Oh, my goodness. And what do you like about cooking over wood? Maybe more than coal or something else.
Yeah, as a chef, I've always been fascinated kind of with what can we do next? What's the, you know, we've all stood over an oven, but what's the showstopper? How are we incorporating a little more energy, a little more flair, a little more flavor, a little smoke and heat and all of that? So we're able to kind of set up an exhibition, you know, outdoor full kitchen and do the thing. And, you know, something very romantic about fire. Very yeah. primal, very primitive. We all love to sit and watch a fire.
Yeah. 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 Oh. And you get a little different taste.
Oh yeah. We love to play with the different char techniques, you know, whether it's with pizza or with meats and proteins. We have a leopard spotting char pattern that we strive for on our pizza, and we finish it with a ring of local honey. We've got 4 beehives on our rooftop. And so we finish the pizza with a little ring of local honey. You get a little, you know, dessert on your crust or kind of a little happy ending before you leave us.
Oh, man. Jeff in Berry Mills has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. I had a question about Italian sausage on pizza. I remember years ago that you would get some Italian sausage that really had a really good anisette bite to it or a fennel flavor. And I can't find a pizza like that anymore. And I've been experimenting myself. I buy pre-made Italian sausage and then add some more fennel to it, but that doesn't do it. So now I'm going to try crushing the fennel to release, you know, a little bit and then add that to the sausage. But I just want your opinion of that sweet type Italian sausage.
Yeah, and that's kind of the sausage that we strive for, and we actually have it on our menu as a sweet fennel sausage. And I got a spice grinder from the Spice House. We've got a couple of them, but we have one that we just use for fennel. So I put whole fennel seed in the spice grinder. We do a couple of grinds of that whole fennel cracked into the oil, and then we do our sausage over the top of it. So you're able to incorporate a little bit more of that kind of cracked fennel. It's permeating through the oil, and then it gets right into that sausage. So maybe try that.
That's a great idea. And I could see why you'd want a separate cracker for the fennel.
Oh, you can't go back after using it for the fennel. Not at all, but it's a good one.
Oh, Jeff, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. John wants to know, what's a Detroit-style pizza?
Oh, a Detroit-style pizza. So we rolled out our Detroit-style pizza our second year in business, and we're doing it wood-fired. And it gets cooked in, it's called a Lloyd pan. So it's a metal pan, and Detroit style originated out of Detroit. So these Detroit pans are what they were using for cars. So car pans, these hard powdered steel coated pans. So we put our dough, and it's kind of a focaccia dough that goes in there. There's a ton of oil. There's a ton of salt. There's a ton of fat. We're using a local flour out of Ridgeway. It's an organic flour from Meadowlark. And you're getting these cheesy caramelized edges in the pan. And so the cheese and the dough kind of mix. And so when it gets cracked out of the pan, you've got this gorgeous rectangular showpiece of just cheese. And then the sauce goes on the top in little racing stripes.
So that's what a Detroit. Oh, man, you're making me hungry.
Oh, it's a good one. Yeah, yeah.
it sounds like a pretty good one. Oh, and in the, I took a look at your mobile menu. You offer a lot of unique pizza toppings, I think, that are you know, dill pickles, arugula.
Oh, yeah.
Foraged mushrooms.
We're right down the street from the West Dallas Farmers Market, and we're so grateful. So they're open three days a week. So we're able to bop down to the West Dallas Farmers Market in season and just be able to kind of cook with the seasons as we go. We grow a lot of what we put on the pizzas in-house, and we're really proud of that, too.
Yeah, and actually, I see that you tend to support local businesses.
We do.
that's your goal.
Yeah. We during our restaurant season, we tend to collaborate with quite a few businesses. We do a Korean pizza, and we work with a Korean chef, and she makes the kimchi for it. And we've done a Ukrainian pizza, and we've collaborated with a Puerto Rican business to bring kind of their Puerto Rican food onto a pizza, and really be able to highlight their business too.
Yeah, that is very, very cool. Dana Spandet, our guest today, chef and owner of Flower Girl and Flame, a pizza restaurant and mobile food truck. They're based in Milwaukee, and great talking with her. Questions for her, maybe about the business itself. I know I've got a bunch more questions about how you run two different kinds of businesses that way she does it. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email the talk at WPR.org. And if you have a question about making pizza yourself, I'm sure she has some answers for you. Give a call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today. Tomorrow on the show, we'll be talking about waterfowl hunting with Brad Heidel and Taylor Finger from the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association. Then we'll talk about fall paddling with Rutabaga Paddle Sports owner Darren Bush and paddling guidebook author Timothy Bauer. That's tomorrow on the show. Right now, visiting with Dana Spandet, chef and owner of Flower Girl and Flame in West Allis. And again, join in, questions, comments about pizza, I hope you will, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. So in 2021, you opened the brick-and-mortar restaurant in Milwaukee, in West Allis. How's that gone?
It's been going really well. So we have 6 months of catering, and then we open our restaurant for 6 months, and that's been kind of an interesting, you know, first couple of years, people were like, what are you doing? Now you're closed. Now you're open. Now we're able to do a grand reopen every year. So we are opening actually this week. And the restaurant goes great. I think, you know, we're giving people a nice little winter home to come in. Our spot's really quaint and cozy. Got a really thoughtful local drink menu. And we switch our specials weekly. So we have a different Detroit style and a different sourdough special every week for people to come and try.
So I'm guessing you're going to be opening the brick and mortar pretty quickly.
We are. Yeah, we are. Yeah. Today's actually our big prep day to get it all done. So I popped out quick to.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to do this. It's hard for me. You've got to do a little marketing or something or advertising if you're going back and forth, do you not?
We do. Yeah. We've got a pretty solid, customer base. And we spend that 6 months of summer, you know, we do lots and lots of weddings, and we do a little bit of public appearances, but we're so wedding centric these days. We just finished up doing the Art of Cheese Festival with the Wisconsin Dairy Farmers Association, over the last weekend. And that was really amazing, working with every Wisconsin cheese that you can think of and putting it on 8 different types of pizza. It was incredible.
So I got to ask, what are the favorites among your clientele? And maybe what's your own favorite?
My personal favorite is pepperoni. You know, there's a lot of ways that we can go with pepperoni, and we just recently did a collaboration with Luke Zahm from Wisconsin Foodie, and we did pepperoni, apple, and black garlic, and it was just such a surprising, but you know, it worked. It's such a nice balance on that one. But I would say our customers, we have a pepperoni and chili crisp pizza that's a little bit Asian centric, and we put some Thai basil on top. That's a popular one for sure.
And you got small, medium, and large, or extra large, or what are your pizza sizes? Somebody's here wondering.
Oh, well, we're kind of a one size fits all. So we just do a 12-inch sourdough pizza, and then we've got a standard sized rectangle Detroit style pizza.
So,
and you can also find, I mean, seasonal salads, and we've got a sumac fennel orange salad that we're putting on the menu this year. We've got a lacinato kale salad, all kinds of good seasonal things.
If you have a square pizza, and I'm thinking about this from a perspective of eating here. Mm-hmm. Will a square pizza go further than a round one, even though they both cover the same area?
That's the
you know
pizza
what I mean?
Math. I do know what you mean. There is so much math and volume of round versus rectangle. For our specific one, our Detroit style pizza is just everything that's extra and wonderful. And so it's a little bit thicker. It's a little bit cheesier. It's a little bit more of everything. So that one's going to definitely give you some more bang on it. We say that our sourdough feeds 2 to 3 people. I do have a 9-year-old daughter, though, that has finished up a whole one on her own. So, you know.
Well, I have a little race with her. I could probably do it too. I can't wait to get down to your area again. I get over to Milwaukee and West Allis, that area, reasonably often, and I haven't been to your place, so definitely going to be coming to your place to give it a try. You also opened Everyone's Ice Cream.
We did. Yeah, pizza and ice cream, right? Pizza and ice cream. So we opened up Everyone's Ice Cream, and we have that lives in the back of our pizza shop.
Okay.
So we've got a few ice cream carts that we go out for catering, but otherwise we've got an 8-flavor dipping cabinet. There's always one house made flavor on, and it's all small batch Wisconsin creameries. So we're using Purple Door, Scratch Ice Cream, Sassy Cow, Chocolate Shop, all the big local hitters.
I understand that. I think it was 2022. You crashed on your moped and suffered a pretty tough injury.
I did. Yeah. I had a traumatic brain injury. And lost my taste and smell, and
which is not doesn't work
that.
Well when you're in
no.
food.
No, it doesn't. So I've been doing some smell training. I have a smell training kit over the past couple of years. I got basil and tomato down pretty good these days, but yeah, it's been a challenge.
I would imagine. I think fellow chefs have probably responded in a helpful way.
In a very big way. We have such a beautiful community of chefs and restaurateurs by us.
I can't imagine being in that kind of situation as a chef, not being able to smell or taste. Oh my gosh, you have. You have, and we've talked about this a little bit, but Flower Girl in Flame, it's women operated, it's a LGBTQ oriented support business. You also source ingredients for women and farmers of color, for example. You really look for that. Why is that important to you? And in the end, how does it help your business?
You know, in 2020, when our supply chain was so uncertain and, you know, we were all kind of restaurants, we're looking at each other like, what are we going to do? And how are we going to safely serve people? And how are you continuing to generate revenue? And how are you making any money these days? And we all kind of started trading with each other. So, you know, we were making pizza sauce and giving it to a farmer's market, and then they were selling it. And it just became so clear that the money that we make needs to stay in our own community, or it's best served if it stays in our own community. And now we're seeing tariffs and taxes and all this stuff. And when we're not feeling any of that, because we're so local oriented, you know, we're supporting our friends, we're supporting the people that need it and that mean something in our community.
That's smart. I was trying to think of what to say about it. I guess it's smart.
It has ended up being pretty smart. You know, we've been pretty untouched with all of the, you know, everything that's kind of been going on with supply chain these past couple of years.
Oh, man. So the ice cream, how's the ice cream doing?
Ice cream's going good. It's always a good day for ice cream, you know. I mean, that one we barely market, I'll be honest with you.
And how do you market?
Well, we're Instagram, we're Facebook, but we're out. We are out there in the community. I don't think we need, you know, I could probably not post for a month, but people are seeing us out making impacts, you know, doing the damn thing.
Do you ever just set the cart up and at a food place or so, you know, when you're having some, maybe a festival or something other than, say, catering it, just set it up and let it go?
We've got plenty of spots, plenty of farms, we do a pizza farms, you know, here and there that are really popular. Get out there.
That's very cool. And you I'm wondering, I mean, you sound like a fun person to if I wanted to have a class.
Oh.
Do you do classes, that sort of thing?
Yeah. We've got some really popular pizza classes that we do. They're great for groups of 8 to 12 people. And it's just such a fun afternoon. Everyone's ice cream is included. We've pulled drinks, lunch, all that good stuff. And you get to hang out with us for the day.
Hang out for the day?
You, Larry. Larry, I think you'd love a pizza class, actually.
I'd be in favor of that. I've done some food classes over the years from time to time with friends. I think a pizza making class, you show me how to throw that pizza crust around the dough.
Oh, we'll get you up to the ceiling. I promise. Yeah.
So the classes, and let's talk about, you got a website.
We do. Yeah.
What's that website?
You can find us at flowergirlandflame.com.
And flower. Is not spelled like the flower, Daisy.
Yes, F-L-O-U-R. Flour has become so important to us. We use two different styles of organic heritage flour, both made locally.
So Flower Girl and Flame is .com, I assume, or .org,
oh, yeah.
Or is it
.com.
It's .com is the place to go to find, and there people can find out where you're located.
Yep.
And coming up, and what everything costs, and what you've got going for you, Dana.
Yeah, come check us out.
You know what? It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much. I'll be down to see you.
Larry, thank you so much for having us. Thank you.
I'll be there to see you. I'm not sure exactly when, but it won't be long. Dana Spandet, she's chef and owner of Flower Girl and Flame, a pizza restaurant and a mobile food truck based in Milwaukee. And that restaurant is going to be opening November 1st for the year. It comes and it goes.
See us.
comes and
That's
it
right.
goes. Great to have her with us, and she's doing some really cool things. And I will be there to see her, and I hope you get a chance to see her as well. Big thanks for listening in today. Well, we really covered a lot, and it was fun. And it's fun because they have a great team of people that work on this. We all work together. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks again for listening. And why not stay with us? Lots more in store here on WPR News.